This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January the 9th, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at making extensions. So this week, we're going to take a look at some of the following developments, shall we say, in the area of taxes. We're going to take a look at the annual Joint Committee on Taxation's report. They updated their list of expired and expiring tax provisions. We'll take a look at the fact that the FinCEN this week created a permanent automatic extension for FBAR reports that are going to be required in 2017 and 2018. So we'll get that piece of good news. We'll find an IRS memorandum that tells us that the fact a corporation had no cash did not excuse it from having to pay an accumulative earnings tax. The IRS released guidance this week on the special rule that was part of the Protecting Americans Against Tax Hikes Act of 2015 that dealt with special relief from having to amend 1099s for minor changes. And the IRS also this week outlined how certified professional employer organizations are going to maintain that status in the future. Now, we're, as again, getting into January and into time where, you know, we're having fewer continuing education courses, but we still have a couple of options for you that I wanted you to consider. First thing, for those of you who can come here to Phoenix or take a part of the Arizona Society's webcast, I am going to be giving a course in advanced tax practice on January the 16th. That course will deal with lots of areas like penalty issues, the new compliance rules that are going to come down for having to do your due diligence with regard to things like the child tax credit or face penalties. We'll take a look as well at securing your computer systems and the threats we have there coming to us. We're going to talk about basically all the interesting things coming up now that are challenging your tax practice for the upcoming tax season. Also, Don Cochran and I are going to be presenting a practitioner's tax form online for CPA Crossings. CPA Crossings partners with a lot of the state societies that are involved around the country. So many of you will find this on your state society websites in your scheduled courses. We're going to be running this. We're going to run a rebroadcast of this on four separate dates. January 12th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, the 23rd at 10 a.m. Eastern, January 26th at 2:30 p.m. Eastern, and January 27th, officially 4 p.m. Eastern. Now, since this is a four-hour CPE course, if you're on the East Coast, that'll run a little bit late in the evening. Obviously, that 4 p.m. Eastern one is going to work better for those of you on the West Coast who are looking to sign up. Again, these four, what we're going to talk about there, we're going to talk about some of the interesting developments from last year. The three new, Don and I will discuss the three tax bills we got last year, which weren't huge. But we'll also talk about some of the more interesting developments from recent past, including the Fleischer case we mentioned a week or so ago that discussed the problem of an S corporation that a person tried to form an S corporation for his investment firm and turned out that the found an impermissible assignment of income, end up with a self-employment tax penalty. We'll also talk about just some interesting areas that cause us trouble. We'll spend some time on areas involving the depreciation and tangible property rules, the changes in Section 179. We'll discuss the passive activity rules. We'll talk about identity theft problems. We'll discuss the partnership audit provisions and discuss other items of interest. This is meant to be kind of a quick, shall we say, miniaturized version of a tax conference. So we'll give you 4 hours, talk about a lot of tax issues. It's available online. You can find the registration at CPA Crossings website, or for many of you, your state societies will have links on their own website. And certainly a lot of state societies participate here. So you want to check your state society site first, but we'd be glad to have you by for any of those four sessions. Now let's talk about this week's tax developments. The first one comes up is from the list of expiring federal tax provisions for 2016 to 2025. This is document JCX-116 from the Joint Committee on Taxation. It has a publication date of January the 8th, 2017. And it contains a full list of the expired provisions that went away in 2016. As you may recall, last year in the PATH Act, Congress did a number of things that were only given a one-year lease on life. Some of those that are significant include the credit for non-business energy property and the residential energy property credits, the Indian employment credit, the exclusion for discharge of indebtedness on principal residences for individuals, the premium for mortgage insurance being deductible as mortgage interest, the domestic production deduction for activities in Puerto Rico, and the deduction for qualified tuition and related expenses. But the report also reminds us of some other things that are expiring that were put into bills prior to the 2015 PATH Act. Most importantly of that group is a reminder that we are going to, that 2016 was the last year that those over 65 will face a 7.5% of AGI floor on their medical deductions, as opposed to the 10% limitation that all other taxpayers face. They go to 10% in 2017. All of these are assuming Congress takes no action to extend them. The bill also goes on, or they should say the document also goes on to talk about future items that will disappear. The biggest set in that regard is going to go away in 2020. We end up having various items disappear at the end of 2019, including bonus depreciation runs out of there, as well as a whole bunch of other items that expire at different times. The Joint Committee has basically lined out expiring items that are in the code right now that go all the way from 2016 to 2025. Next up, some good news we got from the Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. This is their news release issued on December the 16th. Now, this is of interest because that organization, as many of us are aware, is where you file your foreign bank account reports, the FBAR reports, the Form 114. The foreign bank account reports, as you may recall, last year, Congress changed the due date of those reports to April 15th this year, with the possibility of requesting a six-month extension. Now, some of us were getting concerned at this point because you began to wonder, well, does that mean we're going to have to file a separate extension form to extend the FBAR reports in addition to filing an individual extension, because Congress didn't tie the two together that way. They didn't make it as part of the 1040 or make it in a position where it would be considered that the extension would just cover the 1040 like we do now with our gift tax returns. Well, it turns out that we won't have to worry about any of that now. On their website, in their announcement, in the news area, their news release, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network noted that, in their words, to essentially implement the statute with minimum burden to the public and the agency, they're simply going to grant a blanket extension to all taxpayers to the October 15th deadline. So regardless, if you don't get it filed by April 15th, you're just going to be granted an automatic extension with no filing. Now, some of you who, let's say, process returns in California, have California returns, individual returns in California, know that that's basically the rule we work with in California. If you're not going to send a payment, California automatically gives you the extension. So if you don't have a payment due, you simply get an extension of time to file your California return. Well, FinCEN doesn't have a balance due ever, so we're simply going to get the extension. This is not a temporary measure for this year, but is apparently a permanent measure, at least until further notice, from the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. So the good news for all of that means that we will not have to be worrying about coming up with some special filing for FinCEN for basically FBAR extensions next year. Rather, we can simply consider them extended without having any work required on our end. Next up, we have here Chief Counsel Advice 2016-53017, issued on December the 30th. Now, this goes to something that a lot of us may not have paid much attention to in recent years. Some of us who've been in practice as long as I have, remember before the 86 Tax Act, we actually had a whole number of closely held C-Corps. And there was this thing under Section 531 called the Accumulative Earnings Tax. Now, for those of you that may not have ever heard of this tax, because you've been in practice, let's say, for the last 15 years or so, maybe, or 20 years, you probably haven't, never really had to deal with this much. This is a 20% tax that is imposed on excessive earnings held by a corporation. Now, while the law effectively applies to all corporations, the reality is it's only ever imposed on closely held corporations. Also, the burden is on the IRS to show that there's excess amounts being held back. And we, for most corporations, we get a $250,000 worth of accumulative earnings that we can keep without being subject to this tax. Now, this is based on accumulative earnings and profits, less dividends paid out. So you're looking at those excess holdings. In this particular case, the taxpayer had formed a C corporation, and he had contributed a number of partnership interests. Now, these partnership interests, the agreements limited distributions from the partnerships to the amount of tax that the partners would be expected to owe on flow-through income. The taxpayer in this question only had a minority interest in these partnerships. He did not control these partnerships. He could not force them to make a distribution. And the idea behind these partnerships was to hold money in to allow them to be reinvested. The IRS, in examining this C corp, took a look at its cumulative earnings and decided, well, you know, you've got way too much accumulative earnings. We're going to impose a cumulative earnings tax. The taxpayer says, wait a minute, IRS. I'm not holding any money or any assets in here, any assets that I could use as dividends. You know, I don't have any cash to make a dividend distribution with, so the accumulative earnings tax shouldn't apply to me. The chief counsel's office was asked to comment on this situation, and the chief counsel's office decided that, in fact, doesn't matter, you don't have the cash. The opinion, the memorandum noted that this taxpayer had formed this corporation primarily to obtain certain tax advantages, certain state tax advantages and various other tax advantages that if he hadn't formed it, he might have had to pay tax in extra jurisdictions that he wouldn't have to when he did this as a C corp. Well, the IRS said that's fine, but they said the regulations specifically look at a reason to accumulate, and accumulating, if there's no business purpose, but it's only tax driven, is considered to be an indication that you have excess earnings. The IRS stated because of this that in fact you would not be excused from the accumulative earnings tax, but rather they would end up owing the tax the corporation would. Now you might say, wait a minute, he can't pay a dividend. Well, they said, look, there is a special set of rules in Section 565 that would have allowed him to declare a consent dividend, where even though there's no cash paid, he could be treated as receiving a dividend, by the way, on which he would pay tax, and then having contributed it back to the corporation. Since he had that option, and that was the option that was expected to be taken, the mere fact he had no cash was not sufficient to justify this excess accumulation of earnings, and the tax was deemed to apply. Next up is Notice 2017-9. This is guidance issued on January the 4th of 2017 to deal with the rules that were contained in the Protecting Americans Against Tax Hike Act that allowed for relief from penalties for information return filers if there are minor errors that they decide to leave uncorrected. Under the Act, generally there'll be no penalty if there is a change of no more than $100 in income that should have been reported on the information return, or there's a change of no more than $25 in taxes withheld on the information return. Now, this particular ruling points out that regardless of the amount that you pay to somebody, if you don't file the form at all, this is not an excuse for that. So you can't use this to say, well, you know, I had decided, you know, I originally didn't issue a 1099 to Joe. Joe's income was $100 or let's say, or $90. Well, then, you know, that's no big error, so I'm not going to be penalized. The notice makes clear you will be penalized if you do that. The other thing this notice gives is a special rule you need to be aware of. while payors do not have to issue these 1099s, they will still have to issue them if the payee files a election with the organization to ask them to issue these regardless of how much of an adjustment there is. This guidance goes on to effectively tell us how to make that election as a payee. Now, a payee's election has to be, they have to provide, the payor has to provide a reasonable manner for making the elections that can be in writing, online, or by telephone. The ruling does state specifically that you cannot limit the opt-out, or let's say the opt-in to get these additional reports, to merely online. So if you have online, you're going to have to provide at least another option of in writing or by telephone. If the payor does not prescribe a method to make the election, then what the payee can do is issue a request in writing to the payor's address appearing on the 1099 or as directed if you call in and ask about it after an appropriate inquiry. This particular election is going to contain the statement that the payee is making the election to have the 1099s issued, provide the payee's name, address, and taxpayer ID number, identify the type of payee statements and account numbers to which the election applies. That would be something like 1099 dividends. If the payee wants the election to apply to only certain information, so you could request only the 1099 DIV be issued, not worry about 1099 INT. Not sure why you'd go that route, but if you could. And finally, if you want the payee wants the election to apply to only the 1 year for which to make the election, then you state the year it will apply to. Otherwise, it will continue to apply until the payee decides to, you know, reverse the election. Now, this one is kind of interesting. The ruling also states that a payor can simply decide to issue these regardless. This was meant to help eliminate the insanity we get into of those amended 1099s we keep receiving from the brokers that keep coming from, you know, we in mid-February, we get the first shot at it. Then every week or two after, you get one that's revised. And if you're like me, in many cases, it's a 60-page 1099, which changed $1.50 on a page somewhere deep inside the document. And it's up to you to try to figure out what changed and what to do with it, as well as having to deal with clients who receive further amendments after they filed their return, and who get very concerned about not filing an amended return with the IRS because there's a $1.50 difference. So supposedly we'll get fewer of these. However, the fact that the payee is allowed to opt out or essentially say, send me this statement anyway, may cause many payors to just decide the simplest thing to do is not implement an opt-in system, you know, where you'd opt into receiving them, but rather simply decide to keep issuing the amended returns. So we'll have to keep our eyes on whether or not we truly get relief from this provision, but we're going to find out this tax season. So we'll get started there. Finally, in Revenue Procedure 2017-14 that was issued on December the 29th, the IRS issued information about effectively how certified professional employer organizations can retain their status. For those who don't recall, this was added to the law back in 2014. And the IRS, in this case, was going to set up a program where professional employer organizations, PEOs, could attain what's called certified status. Now, the reason why you want to be a certified PEO, or why your client may want to hire a certified PEO instead of a non-certified one, is that if the PEO, for whatever reason, does not make the payroll tax deposits, the company that hired the PEO will not be liable for those underpayments so long as the certified PEO, you know, had at least 85% of the workforce under its payment scheme for the workplace in question. That gets you out of the risk that we saw come up a few times where certain payroll services have popped up, and it turns out they were fly-by-night organizations where they took the money from the employer, but they never gave it to the government. Now, we've already had earlier this year, we had regulations issued and Revenue Procedure 2016-33, Notice 2016-49. that outlined how you could become a certified PEO. This now, a few days before the first certified PEOs came into effect, because this took effect January 1st of 2017, we now get the continuing rules. Section 2 outlines the general procedures for maintaining your status. Generally, to maintain your status, you have to undergo your annual verification procedures, including paying a user fee each year, undergo a background check for the PEO, and a tax compliance check. They're going to have to obtain a bond equal to the combined minimum bond for the CPEO for the total liability for the prior quarter and keep that up. So they may have to adjust that quarterly. Need to annually submit audited financial statements by an independent CPA. And those statements, we have to have compliance with the minimum working capital provisions. So either a note to the financial statements have to talk about compliance with the working capital provisions, or the CPA needs to comment on compliance with those provisions in the examination report. This also must be an unqualified examination report. If it's a qualified report, it doesn't count. They also talk about quarterly submission of assertions that you deposited taxes on time, along with an examination level attestation of the independent CPA on that assertion, and a statement on compliance with the working capital rules. And, you know, basically also reporting the commencement of the termination of a CPO contract with a customer on Form 8973. So you do the commencement or termination, I should say, of it on that form to inform the IRS we've started or we've stopped doing that. Now, Section 3 details information on suspension and revocation of this status. It outlines various reasons why the service could suspend or revoke your status, but notes as well, this is a non-exclusive list. If you fail to comply with the requirements, they effectively can remove your status. It also talks about any the appeals right the CPO will have. And finally, Section 4 outlines how an organization could voluntarily withdraw from the program, as would probably be expected. If an organization does that, they're going to have to notify their customers that they're no longer a certified PEO. The same thing if they have their CPEO status revoked or terminated, they're going to have to tell their customers about this little fact. Presumably the customers, if they got a certified PEO because they want that protection, probably would leave shortly after receiving such a notice. Well, we're getting close to and we're into tax season. So tax season's coming up. And your clients are going to expect you to understand how to handle all these nice little rules to assure that they get to keep their money and don't get run over by the tax, by a bulldozer of taxes, shall we say. And part of the way you're going to do that is consider taking a look at your state society CPE. We have still many state societies continue to offer live CPE through the months of January and even into February. And a number of the states will be broadcasting the California Society webcast for the courses they're going to run through that period, as well as we already talked earlier today, a number of online services will offer various programs that may be archived and self-study or on demand. Be sure to check your state society website for information to get yourself up to speed for this coming tax season and enable your clients to basically retain some of that money instead of sending it off as taxes. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of January 9th, 2017. You can catch our regular updates on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF from that site with articles on all of the things we discussed today. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. My handle there on Twitter is @edzollers. And be sure to join us next week as we'll talk about developments coming up in the area of federal taxes.